This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. The State Fair is one of those signs that summer is underway. And while last year things were different due to the pandemic, now with vaccinations, more things are beginning to open back up, including the State Fair. With us now is Sharon Smith, Director of Communications at the Indiana State Fair. Thank you for joining us today. Sharon, can you take us back to last year? What was it like for the State Fair?
It was an extraordinary experience for our team, who always gets so excited after the end of the previous state fair to start planning for the next state fair. And of course, that didn't happen. We did pivot a bit, and we had an event that allowed us to showcase 4-H youth through livestock competitions and project showcases. So we were able to uplift 4-H in that way. But it wasn't the same. It wasn't the Indiana State Fair. So we are thrilled to be back.
And what were you able to do last year aside from that? Was anything just solely virtual? Did you have any shows virtually, or did everything kind of get put on pause?
Yeah, we did live stream some of the competitions, but many, if not all of the competitions were held in person. And again, it just allowed these kids who had put so much effort into their projects and into their livestock to be able to compete at the state fair level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can imagine, I mean, a lot of this stuff is outdoors and agriculture, animals, things like that. Do you think that after what you went through last year, did you think that it was possible to make a comeback this year and really come back bigger and better?
Yeah, well, we were all kind of holding our breath to see what would happen with the vaccinations. And certainly that was a breath of fresh air to know that we did have a way to truly combat COVID-19. And we also have kept a close eye on the event industry and watching what other events we're capable of, including the Indianapolis 500 and, of course, other state fairs happening around the country. And we are getting a sense that people are truly excited about gathering again and coming out and enjoying this great family tradition. So definitely the vaccinations help turn a corner for everybody in events.
Yeah, absolutely. And when it comes to sort of the other events that you were keeping an eye on, did any of them stand out that you saw do a really good job and have a good turnout?
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly, as I mentioned, the Indy 500 was important because it's in our market and they were working closely with the Marion County Public Health Department. We work closely and have worked closely with both the Marion County Public Health Department and the State Department of Health. And of course, the governor's office, and working with all of those public health authorities was very important to us to get a sense of what we were looking at having to do if we had to make any modifications in regards to capacity, et cetera. And to know now that we can move forward July 30th through August 22nd without any capacity limits. It's just encouraging, again, for everyone on our team to know that we can really offer much of what people expect from their Indiana State Fair.
We've spoken with so many different folks on this program with how the pandemic affected businesses or organizations. I'm curious, did you get hit really hard last year in terms of financials? Did that have any effect on what you would be able to plan for this year?
Yeah, we've had to revisit and reforecast our budget many times. We were down 75% in revenue, and it made a significant impact on our planning efforts. But since we've been able to see some revenue come in, we were a host for the NCAA basketball tournament. We've currently been hosting the Fever, the ICHL hockey team that plays here at the Coliseum. The Indy Fuel was successfully able to host their season. So in some ways, we were down in revenue. In other ways, we balanced it out with new activity. So we're going into the fair in a pretty good position. We need it to be successful. We want it to be successful. But we are positioned pretty positively as we're heading into the fair.
That's great to hear. Well, if you're listening and you have any questions or comments for the show, you can always let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Sharon Smith, Director of Communications at the Indiana State Fair, all about this year's State Fair. Sharon, the State Fair is literally around the corner. What has the planning been like? Have you had extra time now since it was off the table last year? Like, is it even easier now to put something together having all that time?
You know, a staff member called it muscle memory. You know, many of us who have been on the team now for a while kind of know what to expect and have a certain cadence leading up to the fair. But that being said, our schedule has been much more compressed than we're used to. And we are just trying to, again, work hard, and we are putting in extra hours to make sure that we make Hoosiers happy and we put on the best show we can. So it's definitely a different schedule this year leading up to the fair, but we're confident that, again, the highlights of what people can expect out of the State Fair will be offered to them.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the events people can expect to see this year?
Yeah, I know people are really excited about the fact that we'll have free concerts every day during the fair. So we have 18 free concerts lined up, a lot of variety on the free stage this year. We've got Indiana's own Babyface coming home to Indiana. We've got Josh Turner, who's a country music artist. We've got a Latina festival this year that's put on by a Latino radio station, which we're very excited about. We've got Casting Crowns. We've got the Beach Boys. So, again, these are all free concerts with paid admission. So it's a nice value for folks. We also, of course, have our fair food. And our Taste of the Fair food items were announced last week. And the public has just really engaged on social media. And we appreciate the media coverage because the number one reason people come to the fair is the food, right?
Mm-hmm.
So 23 new items offered on the Taste of the Fair food competition. Folks can come out and they can try those items, and they can choose their favorite and vote for their favorite item, either using a QR code at each of the booths that are participating or picking up a ballot at our information booths. And then the winner receives $2,500. And second place is $1,000, and third place is $500. So it's a great kind of people's choice competition.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And we've got other new and exciting kind of programming. We've got a new Ferris wheel coming to the grounds at Hoosier Spirit Park, which is over on the north side of the campus. It will be the largest Ferris wheel in the state of Indiana. It's at about 150 feet tall with 36 enclosed gondolas. So it'll allow folks to get a kind of a bird's eye view of the State Fair and probably also be able to get a nice view of downtown Indianapolis. That's $10 per rider. So that's new. We've got a great activation in our Harvest Pavilion. We always look for family-friendly programming in that location. And we're bringing in a program called City of Bricks, featuring Sean Kenny's Wild Connections made with Lego bricks. So these Lego installations are large, and they're nature inspired, and they help teach about the environment. So it's a free, again, exhibit, and that's offered daily throughout the fair. We've got a new lumberjack show, so a Paul Bunyan lumberjack show. So high quality lumberjack skills such as log rolling and axe throwing. That's five times daily, also at Hoosier Spirit Park. We've got a new 5K 1 mile walk run this year called the Deep Fried Dash, and it benefits Daymar and our own Indiana State Fair Foundation. So people can register to run through the fairgrounds and stop at some iconic stops along the way within the fairgrounds. And then at the end, they get some fair food as some treats. So that's new, and that's August the 4th. So much news. We've got, of course, a lot of the staples that people enjoy, the livestock competitions, as I mentioned, the Indiana State Fair Rodeo at the grandstand, the Demolition Derby, Band Day, you know, lots of programming and lots of free items that folks can experience, again, just with paid fair admission.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like there's a lot going on. I'm trying to think which thing I want to go and take part in besides eating funnel cake and corn dogs.
Right. And a lot of this is available at IndianaStateFair.com. We have our program uploaded to our website. So the best thing to do is for people to plan ahead, because it can be overwhelming to come in and figure out, you know, exactly what you think your family would most enjoy. So it's always good to kind of consume that before coming out, and then always feel free to come on back, because we're definitely worth more than a one day visit.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything like a season pass? Like, can folks come back multiple times, or do they have to pay admission each time they come in?
No, you do have to pay admission every time you come in, but we do have discounts available right now for a family fun pack. So those, again, are all available at IndianaStateFair.com.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to, you know, we can't talk about all this stuff without talking about the fact that we're still in a pandemic. What are there any precautions that are being taken?
Yeah, well, I mean, the safety of our guests and our staff and the entire community is obviously a number one priority for us. But we do ask that folks who are not fully vaccinated definitely follow the guidelines, the CDC guidelines requiring whether and when they should wear a face covering. But for those who are fully vaccinated, including guests, staff, vendors, contractors, you won't need to wear your mask. We're also expanding the fair by an additional weekend on the front end of our schedule. And we did that purposefully because we knew that that's the time when people are most likely to attend, on the weekends. So we wanted to kind of spread out fair attendance a bit more. Of course, most of our programming and activations are outside. We've got a 250-acre campus. But we did want to spread out attendance over the course of another weekend. We are closed Mondays and Tuesdays. That's new this year. And that kind of allows us to refresh programming on those down days, to refresh the campus and prepare for everyone to come back on Wednesday.
Well, thank you so much. Sharon Smith is the Director of Communications at the Indiana State Fair. After the break, we'll be joined by our team at Indiana Public Broadcasting to get updates on the governor's emergency powers case, as well as get the biggest news in Indiana this past week. If you have any questions or comments, you can always reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. The last time we checked in with Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter, we learned that Governor Eric Holcomb and Attorney General Todd Rokita were taking their battle over emergency powers to the courts. Since then, there's been some new development. And joining us to give us the latest on that and other topics is Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Thank you so much for joining us. Brandon, let's get caught up on the latest here. Last we heard, there were lawsuits, and it wasn't necessarily clear where things were heading. What's the status right now?
Yeah, we've gotten a bit of an update since we last talked. So there are two lawsuits dealing with this emergency powers law, which says that lawmakers can call themselves into a special session of the General Assembly during a public emergency, like during COVID-19. And that law really stemmed a lot from legislators' frustration and, in even some cases, anger over a lot of the executive orders that Governor Holcomb issued during the pandemic. So this law, though, Governor Holcomb and others believe it's unconstitutional. And so Governor Holcomb filed a lawsuit against the General Assembly to basically just ask the courts to weigh in, to say, hey, I think this is unconstitutional. They think it's constitutional. You need to tell us which of us is correct. There's also a second lawsuit doing the same thing, trying to find out if this law is constitutional or not. But it was from a Hoosier citizen, a guy named John Whitaker, who served in the governor's office like 40 years ago, but otherwise is an attorney here in Indiana. And he, you know, same question, two different lawsuits. We got an update in both of those cases, actually, in the last few days. First is the governor's lawsuit against the General Assembly. Now, Attorney General Rokita stepped into that one to say, whoa, hold on now. Indiana law says the governor can't sue anybody unless the attorney general gives him permission to do so, because the attorney general's position is that I am the voice of Indiana in court, and therefore, if anybody else tries to be Indiana in court, they can only do so with my permission. That was sort of the first step of that lawsuit, trying to figure out if the governor could even bring this lawsuit in the first place. Well, we got at least an initial answer to that question last week, which is that Attorney General Rokita is wrong and the governor is right, that the governor in this instance, in a case where you're talking about the separation of powers and the governor versus the General Assembly, that in that kind of circumstance, no, the governor does not need the permission of the Attorney General's office. Now, that's not the end of the case, certainly, but at least we got our first answer. And then the other lawsuit, the citizen lawsuit, we got a bit of an answer today about an initial question in that case. Attorney General Rokita, representing lawmakers, said, whoa, this case can't happen right now. It has to happen months from now because the Indiana Constitution prevents lawmakers from being sued while they're in session. And normally they wouldn't be in session right now, but this is a weird year. They have to redraw Indiana's district lines, the redistricting process, and that information they need from the federal government is delayed. And so they are prolonging their session by months, all the way through potentially November of this year. And so they're in session for the vast, vast, vast majority of this calendar year. Well, a county judge said today, no, you can't delay this case because of that. This has nothing to do with that. Let's go forward. So a bit of an update on both fronts.
That's interesting. I was wondering if you could purposely delay and keep the session going just to avoid a lawsuit.
That was brought up in both cases, because the attorney general tried to argue that in both cases, both the governor's lawsuit and the citizen lawsuit. And that was something that the governor's team certainly argued, which is that if you could prevent lawsuits against the General Assembly, they could just keep themselves in session forever. Mm-hmm. And a judge certainly found that compelling as a reason to not allow Attorney General Rokita to delay the lawsuits on those grounds.
Mm-hmm. Now you mentioned Rokita didn't want the governor to sue unless he gave him a permission as the attorney general, and that was it overruled? Like, how would you categorize that? Was a judge the one that made that decision?
Yeah, so a judge. So this was an initial motion, if you will, in the lawsuit. And so a county judge heard arguments over that issue and that issue alone, not the underlying constitutional question here, but that issue alone, and issued a ruling that said, no, Attorney General Rokita is dead wrong. He kind of took apart every argument that Attorney General Rokita and his office have made and said, no, this case, you know, can go forward. The governor has a right to sue. Again, that's not the end of the process, because Attorney General Rokita is asking permission to appeal that ruling. Now, This gets really kind of in the weeds, but I'll just say that unlike the normal appellate process that we often hear about, in this particular one, the judge who gave this initial ruling can decline the offer or the request to appeal entirely. So we will see how that plays out, hopefully here pretty soon, and when we get to the arguments over this underlying question.
Mm-hmm. Now, are we getting into never-before-seen territory yet for Indiana lawmakers with these cases, or is this pretty standard?
No, this is incredibly unusual. It's incredibly rare for the governor to sue the General Assembly at all in any way, shape, or form, and for sort of these intergovernmental battles to play out in court. That's not completely unheard of. We've seen intergovernmental battles in Indiana before, but it's very rare. And this particular case, where the governor is alleging that the General Assembly is trying to take one of his constitutional powers away from him for themselves, that has, at least so far in this initial judge's ruling, he called it a case of first impression, which in legal terms means we've never seen this before. We are make a new ground here as far as the courts are concerned. So it's incredibly rare to even see this sort of battle play out. And on this particular kind of case, this is a first for Indiana.
So it's setting a new precedent, I guess.
Absolutely. In multiple ways, as it turns out.
Yeah. Well, when it comes to taxpayers, how are they involved in these cases going forward? Is their money being used to support either side?
Yeah, absolutely it is. So the governor or the attorney general's office is doing all of this work on these cases with the, you know, with the funds in his office. So it's not like they're requesting new or extra money to do this. It's within the funds of his department, but that's money that's not being used on anything else in his office. And generally how taxpayers feel about that, if they like what Attorney General Rokita is arguing for, that they like this law, that they don't want the governor to succeed, well, then they're fine with him spending those funds to fight this case. If they don't like the attorney general's office, if they don't like what he's advocating for, or if they don't like this law in the first place that the General Assembly passed, well, then they're upset about the taxpayer dollars being used to fight these lawsuits. But that's often true in a lot of different cases. We hear the same sort of arguments with the anti-abortion laws and the lawsuits that come out of them that Indiana gets involved in just about every year. And it's the sort of the same thing. If you like those anti-abortion laws, then you're happy to spend state dollars to fight for them. If you don't like those laws, then you're upset the taxpayer dollars are going to their defense.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Brennan, let's talk about the abortion reversal bill that was blocked by a federal judge. For those who haven't been following, what was going on before the judge got involved?
Sure. Well, this law is one of many that Indiana has passed over the last decade that tries to curtail abortion rights in some way, shape, or form, because Indiana's Republican supermajorities are very opposed to abortion. So what the latest law did was promote a procedure called abortion reversal. And it's a theory that says in a medication abortion, now a medication abortion requires taking two pills at different times. And what abortion reversal purports is that if you don't take the second pill and then potentially take another medication instead, you can stop or reverse the abortion from taking place. The problem is that leading medical organizations call that unproven and unethical because there have been no valid scientific studies that have proven that abortion reversal is safe and effective. The lawsuit that came out of that came after the passage of this law is that the law was telling every doctor in the state of Indiana that they had to tell their patients about abortion reversal, that it could potentially stop or reverse an abortion. And a federal judge, as you mentioned, blocked that law from taking effect before it was set to take effect on July 1st. And the reasoning that the judge gave was you can't put words into someone, the state cannot put words into someone's mouth unless they are true and proven. And this and the best evidence that we have as a scientific community at this point is that it's not yet proven scientifically to be safe and effective.
Right. And is there any argument that, you know, the government shouldn't be getting involved in people's personal health?
Oh, sure. There are lots of arguments about that. But that goes well beyond this single anti-abortion case.
Right.
That goes to the heart of a lot of the anti-abortion laws that Indiana has passed over, like I said, the last decade plus. And although I will note that this is the ninth time that a lawsuit has been brought in the last decade over a newly passed anti-abortion law in Indiana. And as of this new one, those laws, the state has lost, at least initially, in all nine of them.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us this afternoon and sharing all of this information. It's always good to catch up with you. Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. We're now going to switch over and join Lauren Chapman, digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting, to get some updates on some of the stories of the past week. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us. Let's talk about the iLearn standardized testing and the latest on what's happening there.
Yeah. So I learned testing results are expected, I believe, Wednesday. And that, it, of course, is the standardized testing that Indiana launched to replace I-STEP. One thing to keep in mind, because last year was an extraordinary year, was that lawmakers passed legislation called Hold Harmless, so that the results did not negatively impact teacher evaluations or school ratings, in recognition that last year was a pandemic and learning was hard for everyone. So there's a lot of anticipation for what the results will be. The State Department of Education anticipates that the results aren't going to be great. They anticipate that, you know, they will be indicative of learning loss. There's a lot of debate and question about how valuable that data is going to be overall.
Mm-hmm. Well, were folks able to opt out of iLearn if they didn't want to go and take the test in person, for example?
Yeah, so the Indiana Department of Health applied for, very similar to a lot of states in the country, applied for a federal waiver for participation and accountability from standardized testing. But as of May, more than 80% of students had already taken iLearn. The department said in at the end of May that somewhere around 97% of students participated in iLearn. So a lot of students did end up participating, but didn't have to if parents had concerns about sending their kids in for in-person testing, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. That's a pretty big number of people to come together and take the testing, even though it seems like there are some rumblings of folks who aren't really for that.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing to keep in mind, especially with Indiana schools, is that the Department of Health throughout somewhere around 99% of schools had some length of in-person learning throughout the pandemic last year. Mm-hmm. And in the spring. So a lot of students were in class, were in person, were on some sort of version of schedule that allowed them to be in person already to take tests. So there was probably less of students being out of class for standardized testing.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been keeping an eye on these different COVID-19 variants, and lately everyone's been talking about the Delta variant, although I do think there have been some newer ones popping up. Are we not seeing any movement on the state level to bring back restrictions as we hear more troubling news about how contagious these variants are?
Yeah. So last Friday, Indiana health officials had a press conference and basically said they're not planning any more statewide COVID-19 restrictions, even as they were sounding the alarm about the Delta variant. Since the end of June, we've seen a 54.5% increase in the number of Delta variant cases that we are testing for in the very small sample size of cases that Indiana is doing genetic testing on. Comparing that to one of the older variants, like the Alpha variant, we've only seen a 7.5% increase. So this is an alarming jump. But the state health commissioner on Friday basically said, look, the state's not planning any new or renewed statewide restrictions, but pointed back to individual communities and schools in consultation with their local public health officers may decide to add restrictions, which, because of legislation passed during Indiana's General Assembly, is a little bit more limited than it was just a year ago.
Mm-hmm. So some people may be bringing back, let's say, mandating some masks for their businesses.
Yeah, I mean, the businesses are well within their rights to do so. So far, I haven't heard of any communities that are moving in that direction. I know Marion County in Indianapolis hadn't made any movement about rolling back some of those restrictions or anything along those lines. And it also comes down to the kind of vaccine population that we have, right? We hear a lot about the Delta variant and how it's, you know, decimating you know, communities that are unvaccinated. And when we look at places like Missouri, for example, we line up pretty closely with them. And so the state health officials that were talking on Friday were like, go get vaccinated, because that's our best defense against the Delta variant is making sure that you're vaccinated.
Right. Absolutely. Well, we have about a minute left. Do you think you can give us a quick run through about the federal election reform bill?
Yes, I can. It's called the For the People Act. It does a bunch of stuff, including making Election Day a federal holiday, automatic voter registration, restricts voter roll purges, which is a big deal in Indiana, expands vote by mail, voter verified paper ballots to improve election security. And last week, a number of election focus groups led by Common Cause Indiana and several others came together to put pressure on Senators Young and Braun to support the For the People Act. Whether or not that happens is kind of neither here nor there, but there's a lot of they're making a lot of noise about a federal election bill that may end up being really important.
And that was Lauren Chapman, digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up, we'll learn about a startup that aims to bring peace to families victimized by crime and bring the spotlight back to cold cases. We'll learn all about that and more in just a moment. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can always reach out to us on Twitter or Facebook at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Zob. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Our guests are indie tech veterans behind the startup company Uncovered.com. They hope that their work will be able to leverage an online network of true crime fans to help investigate unsolved cases and help bring peace to families of victims. With us today are the three co-founders, Ashley Fujawa, Anna Eaglin, and Jim Brown. When it comes to this project, how has law enforcement's response been? Have you been in touch with them?
So yeah, so we've definitely spent some time with some law enforcement officials, and a lot of what we hear is, you know, a lot of these case files sit, you know, in binders, and they're paper-based, and they haven't been touched. I think, you know, law enforcement, again, is so overwhelmed with the work that they need to do, and we know there's just not enough resources to put toward these cold cases. So we know that there's an opportunity here. Again, we always hear law enforcement officers say, we hear departments say, you know, we could use your help with this. You know, if you see something, say something. And so we really believe that there's a great opportunity for us to partner and work together.
And Jim, what's that been like so far? Have you worked on anything?
We have. It's been all across the board. As you can imagine, there's a spectrum of law enforcement agencies, and some going more traditional, conservative in their approach and old school methodologies to more progressive, those leaning into the internet and the public being helpful. So a couple examples. We have worked to talk to First Sergeant Bill Dalton with the Indiana State Police. There's a 40-year-old still cold case with the Burger Chef murders. Four teenagers were murdered after their shift over in Speedway, Indiana. As I sat in his office, he pointed behind his desk and literally to six different 4-inch thick binders and said, Jim, that's the case right there, right? 40 years. It's like paper. It's handwritten notes. It's like mentions of just first names. Like, how do you do anything with that? And so as we started to explain to him what we're doing, he's like, look, if you could just get all of that digital by itself, that's a huge win. But then, as Anna has talked about with the product that we're developing, if you can then start to lay that out on a map and then put that into a timeline of events and be able to click and drag and move everything around, that's amazing. And then if you can start to index who the people are, how they're connected, and be able to show profiles of them, like, this would change the game for us. We've worked with Detective Mickey Hamilton in Washington State I think it was a 10-year-old cold case, maybe 10 or 15-year-old, of the disappearance of Nancy Moyer. And in fact, I'm not going to say that case is solved, but citizen detectives helped break that case. So there was actually a confession. The next day, the gentleman who did it turned around and recanted his confession. But the details that he gave were enough to know that we're going to head down the right path. But then there's the opposite of that. There's a case that we're working on in Baltimore, Maryland, Baltimore County, Maryland, where the detective there of 20 years, this case has no interest at all in working with the family, working with us, working with the public. We've tried, there have been other organizations that have tried to give money for DNA testing, and they just absolutely slammed the door in our face. So different responses from different agencies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that this could be, because it's new and different, some folks, it's going to be hard to get them on board just yet. But I wonder, Ashley, are you hearing from anyone that's just a little bit nervous about having their information out there? You know, somehow they were part of a case, maybe they were a witness, and they just don't want their name out there.
Yeah, I mean, that's a real possibility, particularly when you're dealing with cases in communities where there's no oversight or there's no shared vision or mission of what you're working on. That's why, again, we work in all publicly available information that has been put out in one form or another. We're just organizing in a way for people to understand better. But that's where it's also critical for us to be able to work with institutions like Purdue and doing trainings with the National Freedom of Information Coalition. And again, showing people how to properly do this and have access to experts and what is actually needed and what can be helpful in these instances.
Mm-hmm. And actually, has anything like this website existed before, or is this something brand new?
No, this is brand new. I mean, there are different databases in different communities, particularly with the Trans Stowe Project or Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. But there's no one centralized database that spans across the country that looks at all of the unsolved cases of the murdered and missing. And not in a way that connects the information that makes it consumable for people as far as anything more than just a photo or a few data points. This is all of the information in one spot, and it's continuously being updated as more information comes in. And then layering on that activated community is crucial here to get people to have conversations and to talk about what's needed in these communities, not just for how to solve a case, but how we can be more empathetic. So these aren't just stories. And it's not just a genre that I'm interested in, but it's how as a community we can lift each other up and help.
And Anna, is there any plans like, so you're based with your team right now, are you going to expand to other parts of the country, or is this just in one location and you're going to take things, I guess, digitally?
Yeah. I mean, so our team is, we're totally remote team right now. Even though Ashley and I live in the same city, we still mostly work remote. So we're planning to stay that way. We think the best way to kind of recruit and hire and get the best people is to stay remote. As far as where our cases are located, a lot of our cases come from submissions. People come to our site, they submit a case they care about, either they're connected to it or they're not. Sometimes we have a lot of people who follow cases they have no, you know, connection to. They might have a geographical connection to. But we're looking to really expand. We want to have cases all over the United States. We want to expand into other countries. So really for us, it's just a matter of, again, building that infrastructure to make sure we can support that information. But what we really value is when people come to us and say, hey, here's this case I really, really care about. And that's where we get a lot of the cases that we have on the site right now.
Well, if you have any questions or comments for the show today, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Jim, I'm wondering, you know, with using sources from online and culling through all of that, there's bound to be some misinformation or things that aren't accurate. How do you decipher that and find out what's worth keeping and what you throw out?
That's a fantastic question. And what's ironic for us is, you know, there's been a lot of media coverage of us as we've kind of gotten this off the ground, which we're extremely grateful for. But the misinformation about our project and the things that we've been saying, that alone is crazy. So to think that that's not happening with these cold cases, it just would be absurd. So yes, there is misinformation out there. And so this is where artificial intelligence, machine learning starts to come into play as well. So we're actually creating algorithms to understand what sources of information are the most reputable. Doesn't mean they're perfect. It just means that we know more often than not it's going to be reputable. And that can be websites, that can be people, that can be law enforcement agencies, all of that kind of stuff. So that's one thing, creating an algorithm for reputation. But then also we can start to see how do I want to say this? The community almost, I don't want to say voting because that's not the right word, but I can't think of it off the top of my head. But the community is going to be able to say the fact checking for us and say, no, I've run this down. Here is a different source that actually points to what we believe is the correct information. We don't take that on its head. We have a verification and substantiation process that, again, we run through multiple systems of fact checking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it makes me wonder, too, you know, if someone is accused of something or put out there and it's not accurate, you know, how would you deal with something like that?
Yeah. So the one thing we will not tolerate in our community at all is the idea of doxing innocent people. So there's no mentions of any names allowed on the platform unless it has actually been put out there by law enforcement into the public domain. So, you know, we are on that on a regular basis, seeing if there's a name mentioned, it's immediately stripped from the search again, unless it's been verified by law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. And Anna, talking about these algorithms and these different tools that you're going to be using, how does machine learning and AI factor into all of this?
Yeah, so we really see that kind of being the future of the data that we're pulling together. So one thing that we do understand, though, is that technology is not a neutral thing. So we understand that when we build these algorithms, we put in this machine learning, we want to do it in a very thoughtful and ethical way. Because there's a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of issues that have come out definitely in the last couple of years about these algorithms that are just kind of trained on biased data. And so we're really being extremely thoughtful about how we apply this type of technology. So for us, what we see the AI and machine learning, again, kind of what like Jim said, is pulling together connections that people haven't been able to make before. So, you know, there's a lot of data about missing persons, cold cases out there. But what we want to do is pull in even more information, not just where did the crime take place, but what were the multiple locations of the crime, not just the person that was the victim of the crime, but who are their associates? Who are they with? Who is their family? If we can bring in all that different data together and we can tie it, and we can, again, run these algorithms to say, you know, I'm seeing a connection here I've never been able to see before. Or I'm seeing, you know, I'm looking at this location and I'm seeing, a murder case and a missing case. And these have a lot stronger connections than any human would be able to see and compute. So we really do think that there is a great opportunity to apply these techniques to just see data in a way it's never been seen before. And we're really excited to get to the point we can start doing that.
Mm-hmm. It sounds a bit like a mix of data journalism and some detective work here.
I think data journalism is such a great analogy, definitely, for what we're doing. And, you know, and I think journalism isn't too, because a lot of times when we think about these big ethical questions, we look to data journalism and we look to journalism in general, because a lot of these ethics about, you talked about naming people, about doxing, we look to the people who have come before us to say, you know, what's the right path here? We definitely believe that we are doing something brand new, but we think that there's a lot of great frameworks that we can utilize that have already been established.
Mm-hmm. And Ashley, when we're talking about these cases that go unsolved, just for listeners and for myself to understand a little bit more, a cold case, is it generally they've given up and it's closed, or it's just sitting there?
Most of the time it's sitting there. So for our reference, what we utilize on our side within our community is a case that it's at least 36 months old that hasn't had any substantial movement. That means very different across the country. And as you can imagine, different law enforcement agencies have different terms. But that's what we have seen to be just kind of the model and best practices. So we're able, again, to pull in that publicly available information, work with a family advocate or a content creator. But getting that conversation happening again, I appreciate what Christopher said before in the last interview about it's not just a story, but these are discussions that can happen and start to talk about how we can do better and how we can connect and what we know and who we know.
Mm-hmm. And are there certain cases that typically go unsolved? Do you see any trends with which cases become cold cases?
Unfortunately, it's the communities that, again, aren't being properly represented in the media, the justice system, or the community. So, for instance, Indigenous women, they face murder rates that are 10 times the national average, particularly the LGBTQ+ and trans community, or even the Black community are facing incarceration rates and declining murder clearance rates. So here's an opportunity for us to go into a community, into a genre that is already interested in a subject matter and consuming information, but then introducing them into cases that they haven't heard about or victims whose stories need to be told. So whether that is by location, like Anna mentioned, hey, you're listening to a case out of Baltimore County, let's introduce you to three others. And it's probably cases you haven't heard of because they haven't got proper representation. Or here's a case that has, you know, similar background. And if you're interested in it and you could use your skills in X, Y, or Z, that would be really mediated here as well.
And Jim, when it comes to some of the obstacles in getting these cases solved, what have you come across so far? What are the biggest things that stand out to you?
Well, right now, I think that there's a social issue or social movement with trust of law enforcement agencies. And so it's the public talking to law enforcement, right? There's distrust there. And so I think that's one of the biggest things is a lot of these communities just don't want to share the information that they have. And so hopefully with our platform, what we're able to do is infiltrate those communities and get the information that is out there. It does exist, and get people to talk. A lot of times people will have information that they think, oh, that's just such a small piece of information. No one needs to know about that. Or they already know about that. I'm not going to be able to provide any help. Those are the things that break the case. And so we want to give people the opportunity to voice that, and sometimes need to do it anonymously. It's interesting, you know, you mentioned unsolved mysteries and like the tip lines and phone numbers and all that kind of stuff earlier. Like, people don't want to have their voice heard sometimes. And so being able to do it via email or text message or something along that, we want to give people every single means to share the information that they have, because that one tip could break the case.
Well, speaking of some of these communities, like communities of color, Anna, who have rightfully so had issues with law enforcement, how do you develop rapport with them to get them to open up?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, I think it's a lot of like, you know, your actions are going to speak louder than your words. And so one thing we really value on our site, when we decide what cases we want to put on the site, you know, of course, we have to, because we are doing a lot of this manually today, you know, it takes us time to get things up. So we actually have we've built our own algorithm that surfaces cases that we're going to do in order. And so we score cases, and we prioritize cases where the person is a person of color, again, indigenous, are they LGBTQ+, are they trans, were they a sex worker? Because, you know, God forbid you engage in any kind of survival sex work and then something happens to you, you get zero media coverage. You don't get attention on your case. And so we really are looking for those cases that are just not being covered, that no one seems to want to spend time on, because a lot of times those are the cases that we just need one connection to really make something happen there. So for us, you know, we talk a lot of, it's one thing to talk about this, it's one thing to say you're committed to it, but we want to show it in the actions. We want to show it in the cases that we put on our site. And that's how we really believe we can say, you know, it's one thing to say you're an advocate, but this is how we want to be an advocate, is to really draw people's attention to these cases that need them.
Mm-hmm. We're also being advised by advisors in this area. So one of our advisors is Angel Turner, whose sister was murdered in 1997, Georgia Lee Moses. And she has struggled for a very long time, not only to find peace in this case and to find out exactly what happened, but to get information and to have her story told properly in the media, but information definitely from law enforcement as well. So being able to come alongside her and provide an opportunity that she can own her narrative and own the information that she has out there, but additional training that we're able to provide with people. We're working with a journalist out of Louisville who actually interviewed us and then reached out specifically and said she wanted to provide more. So now we're able to couple that with opportunities with family. When they're on air, you know, they have a 3-minute soundbite to tell a horrific story or instance that happened, and to get that information out, we're able to provide sources and resources to be able to do that. But we're also being led to say, this is how you should talk about this. This is how you should approach. Anna mentioned we have cases submitted. We have so many cases submitted. So being able to organize that information and prioritize is key. But we also want to let family members know that we hear you and we're here to support. So making sure that we're talking in a thoughtful way and communicating and over communicating as much as we can, so we're not a burden in this process, but we're helpful.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're just about out of time. We have about a minute left. Jim, what's next for the company as you move forward? What are the next phases?
Well, we're finally starting to open up our membership community so people can now come in. We're starting to do some white glove onboarding to, as both Ashley and Anna have said, teach them how to use the tools that are available to them to help get involved in this. In our research, we learned that the two main things that it takes for someone to want to get involved in a case is obviously knowing the victim, right, or being related to the victim, or second, living in the geographical proximity. So we're looking on ways to bring communities together around the cases that already exist, and then again, exposing those tools to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you all so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time and insight into this project. Good luck with everything. Ashley Fujawa, Anna Eaglin, and Jim Brown are co-founders of the startup company Uncovered.com. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. You can join us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana if you have any questions or comments, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Join us Monday as we look into life expectancy and what a study reveals when it comes to Hoosiers. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.